Well, that was just a little bit longer break at lunchtime there. It's not quite lunchtime, I guess, at 11:15. You're listening to Glenn Coble, and we're on the air with On the Air. How's that? And we also have a guest, Fred Malone. Fred, how are you? Are you back?
Good. Still here.
All right. Excellent. Well, we're talking about stereoptics, and those were some of my favorite toys when I was young.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Well, as I said, I still have my ViewMaster. I actually have a couple of them. And on occasion, if I'm at a flea market or someplace like that, and I see some ViewMaster reels of Niagara Falls or something that grabs my attention, I'll pick them up, and if they're reasonably priced, and bring them home, put them in the ViewMaster, and take a peek.
Do you ever see any of the stereoptic cards anymore?
Oh, sure. Yeah, okay. Absolutely. Yeah. I find them all the time at antique malls and at flea markets and things. In fact, there was the Civil War show a couple of weekends ago over in Mansfield, and I bought three or four over there of Niagara Falls views that I didn't have. So, yeah, you can still find them. And some you can pick up cheap, some are quite expensive.
Yeah, I bet they are. Especially based on
the Civil War show, they had some from the Civil War.
Those usually
command prices of $40, $50, $60 each.
Oh, my.
Because, you know, a lot of them are pretty gory. There were some scenes that Matthew Brady took and that type of thing. So.
Mm-hmm.
And even ViewMasters of certain things are getting to get a little expensive.
Hmm.
You used to be able to pick them up for a quarter or 50 cents.
Yeah.
But now, you know, depending on the subject matter, I've seen them as high as $6, $7, $8 a piece.
Wow.
for one reel. So.
I better go find mine. I know I have a couple.
Yeah, well, and there were so many different subjects. It was, according to the information that I have, it was originally meant as an educational tool. In fact, during World War II, the U.S. military, which I did know this, commissioned and bought millions of special sets of ViewMasters to train personnel to identify aircraft and artillery.
Oh, my. Yeah.
And that makes sense. You know,
yeah, because they
were small, they were portable.
In 3D, so you get
to see a little bit more. Yeah. Flip in a reel and tell, you know, what you were looking at in the sky flying over by what was on the reel.
Yeah.
In the 1950s, the ViewMaster then really became the 3D alternative to picture postcards of tourist attractions.
Mm-hmm.
And like you said earlier, Niagara Falls, the Grand Canyon, all those different types of places appeared on these cards. And in the 50s, people did take vacations and went to different places, but mm-hmm. there were places that you knew you were never going to get to.
Yeah.
And this way you could see them.
Well, now, also, that kind of started about that time, I guess late 50s, early 60s, were those little keychains that had that little single image that you could look through.
I think I've still got one or two of those.
Yeah, those are cool.
Yeah. Those were sold as souvenirs at almost any place you went. In fact, I think I used to have one of the Blue Hole up in Castalia, which doesn't exist anymore. That's private property now, and you can't even see it anymore. But but unfortunately, you know, by the mid-60s, late 60s, the ViewMaster was kind of falling on hard times.
Sure.
And then really they started developing slides of animated characters, cartoons, you know, Tom and Jerry and things like that to try to spark some more interest. But by that time, it became more of a toy rather than an educational thing. So, but very fun to have. And for those of you, of our listeners that have one, get it out and get out your reels and take a look at them again because it's fun. You always have to look into a light source so, to get the full picture. But lots of fun, lots of fun. I don't know. This might be something that some people aren't really familiar with. They were really popular from the 1870s up through the 20s, and that would be the Iron Mechanical Bank.
I loved them. Yes. I have two or three.
I have an Uncle Sam one. That's the only one I have is an Uncle Sam one. But they were made of brightly painted cast iron. They were fitted with spring-action mechanisms. And they were, you know, as we said, they were really a prized possession for kids from that time frame. It encouraged people to save. Usually kids were saving pennies, you know. Ben Franklin's "a penny saved is a penny earned" was a common phrase during that time. But even then, the greatest thing that kept the juvenile kid interested was the fun of operating the bank. And they came in all different types of banks. I remember, I don't know what you have, but my Uncle Sam, you put the penny in his hand and press the button, and he would drop it into a carpet bag. And I know there was one that was a dog. You'd put the penny in a certain place, and the dog would open its mouth.
The one I have is William Tell shooting an apple off a kid's
head. William Tell, that was a very popular one.
Mine is a replacement. I mean, it's not a real one. But.
Yeah. There was another one that they mentioned about Punch and Judy.
I haven't seen that.
There was a Punch and Judy one. There was trick horses, a horse that would jump through a hoop, or a dog that would jump through a hoop, and a horse that would rear up. There was an Irishman. They called it Paddy the Irishman. He stuck his tongue out to catch a penny tossed up by a pig. Some of them were very crude. Some of them were very very intricate. While the elders, of course, deposited dollars in savings institutions through those decades, children could activate a little magic each time they put their coin away.
Well, and weren't there an awful lot of them that were depictions of African Americans?
Oh yes. There were many of those that had the typical blackface on them, right?
Yep.
And really, today, those are the most sought after.
I bet they are.
In the collectors, and there are people that specifically collect mechanical banks. And if you check like the internet or even in some antique malls, you occasionally see them. They're quite pricey, and we're talking $700.
Yeah, the one I have was William Tell shooting the penny off the or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen the original one. If you want to buy the original one, you're going to spend $500 or $600.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And the water and the ones with the blackface. I remember there was one that had involved a watermelon and that type of thing. And those are upwards. Those are in the $1,000 range now.
Wow.
If you can find one.
Yeah.
So, but a very interesting thing to collect and something that we still see today. Obviously, they're not making those anymore, but a couple of years ago, my wife for Christmas got me one that's made out of plastic, a new one that's made out of plastic.
They have made out of plastic.
With a coon dog on it, and you, it's actually has a little mechanism that makes it shake the coin and drop it in the container. It's really kind of cute. But they are still making some derivations of that metal bank, but I don't think you'll see any new metal banks made. There are some reproductions out there, as you say, and you have to be careful if you're a bank collector, a mechanical bank collector. You have to watch that you don't get a reproduction. And you know the people that are out there conning people are very good at what they do.
Yes,
so,
they are.
They'll try to put them out in the weather and get them weathered and make them look older than they really are.
But, I watch American Pickers quite often.
Yeah, I do too.
And, you know, you think, oh, that's really neat. I bet that's going to be worth a lot of money. And then he'll point out, well, did you see this little rivet?
Yeah,
they didn't have that type of rivet in that day.
Turns out to be a thing. Well, and the other thing is not just mechanical banks, but cast iron banks in general.
Yeah.
They were very popular during that same time frame. They didn't have any action involved in them.
Right.
But they were made out of cast iron. In fact, my wife has a pretty huge collection of cast iron dog banks.
Wow.
She collects dog items. And you have to be careful there because they are
breakable.
Reproducing ones.
And they are breakable.
Well,
you have to be careful.
You have to be careful,
Don't want to drop it.
Yeah.
They're brittle.
But you have to also be careful that you don't end up buying one that's been reproduced because there are some of those out on the market. So, anyway, metal banks, very popular in the day. This is something that's interesting, and there's some very interesting people that were involved in this. And I'm going to call it, for lack of anything else, Foxy Spirits.
Oh, I don't. You've got me lost.
Okay. In 1848, the mischievous prank of two children was all it took to set off a countrywide craze for spiritualism. Spiritualism, a meaning that will last for 50 years. It started out when the Fox family moved into an old supposedly haunted house near Hinesville, New York. Now, apparently, planning to tease their superstitious mother, 14-year-old Maggie and 11-year-old Kate began making strange sounds in the night with the aid of an apple tied to a string.
Oh, my.
The girls further alarmed their parents by pretending to talk to a spirit, Mr. Splitfoot, who responded with mysterious rappings throughout the house. Now, when neighbors were brought in to listen and pronounce the spirit responses genuine, the craze was underway.
Oh, my.
Their older sister, Leah, with whom the girls went to live in Rochester, sharpened Kate and Maggie's act first by spreading the word that Mr. Splitfoot was the ghost of a murdered man, and then working out a system of knee-cracking and toe-tapping signals that enabled them to communicate with the netherworld. Much of the sisters' credibility grew from their knack for making their joints crack without any perceivable movement. Now, as interest in the Rochester rapping soared, the sisters played far and wide to standing room only audiences. Although Leah would pocket much of the earnings, the girls were able to make as much as $100 or more in a night in exchange for their communicating with the long-lost dead loved ones.
Oh,
with profits so easy to come by, the Foxes soon were joined by a host of imitators willing to prey on grieving parents and spouses both in America and in England. Mary Todd Lincoln, for one, and Queen Victoria were among those who fell under the spell of the spirit mongers.
Queen Victoria?
Queen Victoria, yes. And, of course, Mary Todd Lincoln, trying to make connection with her dead children.
Well, she was a little odd anyway.
And she used to have, she was a little bit off a rocker.
That's what I meant.
But she used to have seances while they were in the White House trying to conjure up the spirits of Willie, who had died, and I forget the other one. Pat, I think, was the other one that passed away. So, you know, those were two of the more famous ones. The sisters eventually tired of the carnival atmosphere surrounding their trade, and in 1888, with Kate's approval, Maggie made a public confession of fraud, denouncing spiritualism as hypocrisy and a social evil. But in true melodramatic fashion, it came too late. Desolate and broke, both were dead within 5 years. Leah, too, passed on, having made a small fortune on her sister's talent. One of the other ones that came to mind when I was reading about this was Houdini. Do you remember the story of Houdini?
Well, I remember Houdini.
He was a famous magician.
Yeah.
Famous.
Who couldn't get out of the water fast enough.
Yeah, that's what eventually killed him, I guess. But he was very, very close to his mother.
Oh, I didn't know.
Extremely close to his mother. He was what you would call a mama's boy.
Mm-hmm.
And when his mother passed, he had vowed to try to make connections with his mother.
Oh, I remember some of that.
To the spiritual world. And traveled the world and went to all kinds of different mediums and spiritualists trying to find his mother, and eventually always debunked them all. But on his deathbed, he promised his wife that if he could, he would make it back. So she actually carried on the same thing that he was trying to do with his mother. She kept trying to contact him through seances and mediums and so forth, and of course was never successful in doing it. But and from this sprang the Ouija board.
Oh, I didn't know that came from Houdini.
Yeah, it eventually evolved, not just from the seances and the mediums, but it evolved into the production of the Ouija board, which occurred sometimes in the 30s, if I remember correctly.
My cousins used to scare the daylights out
of me. Oh, listen, I'll tell you, there are people still today that believe in that Ouija board, and some people won't allow them in their house.
Well, and it is kind of scary.
Well, it is.
Yeah, it does
is.
Move.
And, you know, you never know where the person you're playing the thing with is moving it,
right,
or whether it's moving by itself.
Or you're just shaky hands.
Well, you know, the old adage was that you could invoke an evil spirit into your home if you fooled around the Ouija board. So,
is that right?
I'm not sure how popular they are now, but when I was a teenager, they were quite popular.
You can still buy them. I've seen them.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. But when I was a teenager, they seemed like they always appeared at about every party I went to.
Oh, all the parties,
All the parties you went to. So the spiritualism craze, I don't think, is dead, no pun intended, to this day, but I don't think it's quite as popular as it was during the late 1800s and the early 1900s, especially into the 20s and 30s.
I think there's some spiritualism outside of the Ouija board that's going on right now. But
well,
that's
true. By the way, I just happened to look up at I always keep CNN on to catch the time. I think they're fairly close to what you are, and it looks like the commission that they're trying to form to investigate the insurrection on January the 6th is going to fail in the Senate.
No big surprise. Probably was. Yeah.
All right. Okay. I want to move on and talk a little bit about how popular blades, became in the earlier days.
And
I'm talking about ice skating and roller skating. This is kind of funny. Recalling his youth in New York City around the turn of the 20th century, Harpo Marx once remarked that his family's only piece of athletic equipment was a single ice skate with a broken strap. He went on to say, "I spent many hours on the frozen pond in Central Park skating gimply around the edge on my one left foot skate."
That's funny.
And, you know, skating, ice skating was extremely popular in the 1800s and clear up into the 1900s.
Sure.
He was far from the first city dweller to dream of gliding effortlessly on a pair of ice skates, especially in the second half of that 19th century, because ice skating was really all the rage.
Mm-hmm.
Interest in the sport began to develop in 1848 when a guy by the name of E.W. Bushnell, a Pennsylvania mechanic, devised the first sturdy all-metal hardened steel skates. This, of course, was an improvement from what they had used earlier, which were made out of wrought iron and wood, and probably didn't last nearly as long.
Yeah.
By 1850, Philadelphians had founded the first social club for the improvement, pleasure, and companionship and safety of skaters. To say that they were serious about safety is really faint praise. In the winter of 1869 alone, club members rescued 259 skaters on the Scully Hill River.
Oh, my.
And I'm assuming that they had fallen through the ice.
I would guess,
in trying to skate. And I know as a child, my mother, who the family grew up in Scioto County, which is along the Scioto River, which led into the Ohio River, grew up in Lucasville, Lucasville being about 12 miles north of Portsmouth. Portsmouth being the county seat for Scioto County and sitting right on the Ohio River. Have you been to Portsmouth before?
Yes, I have, several times.
Famous for the flood wall.
Yeah.
The painted flood wall.
Yeah.
But
and,
as a child, girls. My mother and her siblings and friends would don their ice skates when the river froze over, and they would skate on the Scioto River all the way to Portsmouth.
Oh.
12 miles away.
On the Ohio?
On the Scioto River.
Oh, on the Scioto.
Which emptied into the Ohio River.
I was going to say,
River very seldom... Close.
Yeah.
I can only recall one year, which would have been in about Daniel Boone's time, maybe a little bit later, when the Ohio River froze over.
Most I doubt
of the time,
that you
because
recall
of the currents
it.
And the swiftness of the river, it doesn't freeze over. But the Scioto River, not being, of course, as nearly as deep or,
right.
or nearly as swift flowing, would freeze over quite frequently. And she told stories of oftentimes how they would skate to Portsmouth to go shopping.
You know, I lived in South Bend, Indiana when I was a young person, and I remember I was about 14 years old. They built an outdoor skating rink that was artificially kept freezing, so you didn't have to put water down and hope it stayed cold.
Right, they had some means of keeping it cold.
Yeah, and that was
very popular today. You can get backyard ice skating rinks.
You can.
Jim Gunnell always talks about the on Channel 6 the ice skating rink he sets up in his backyard when winter comes. And up in Sycamore, where I lived for a number of years, the town bought one several years ago and would set it up in the town park for kids.
Mm-hmm.
And it had some way of keeping that frozen. It wasn't very thick.
Right.
I don't imagine maybe over 3 or 4 inches thick, but it was enough that they could skate on. And there were there was a family in town that had a small pond in their backyard right inside the city limits that was only... I don't know, it was less than 6 to 10 inches deep,
mm-hmm.
and it would freeze over every winter, and I used to take my son down there ice skating.
Yeah.
So it was a very popular sport even then, but it really gained its popularity in the mid to late 1800s.
Hmm.
It was a young New Yorker by the name of Jackson Haines who transformed skating into a free-flowing, graceful sport. He was a ballet master and actor by training. But he developed this flamboyant style of skating that thrilled audiences, initially proved too difficult for many others to do. And, of course, we all think about the prolific Olympic skater, Sonia Haney.
Oh, yeah.
Who also appeared in movies back in the 30s.
Who wouldn't be considered very, very skilled anymore.
Oh, absolutely. Very flamboyant, thrilled, you know, audiences. And I think she was an Olympic gold medalist, if
I think so.
Correctly, I don't remember what year, but so soon after being crowned United States champion in 1863, Haines left to make his fortune in Europe. He set up skating schools in Vienna and other places throughout Europe. And then, of course, by 1906 and 1908, it had become a popular Olympic skating event during the Olympics, and that was popularized by Haney's particular style of skating. Meanwhile, Americans were skating whenever and wherever they had the chance, though strictly a seasonal affair, obviously. Skating was surely a favorite activity when lakes and ponds were frozen over. Mm-hmm. During a month-long period of particularly fine ice in the mid-1816s, for instance, over 200,000 skaters turned out with their blades on in central New York, Central Park.
When was that? Do you know when that was established, the Central Park?
Central Park, theater? Much earlier than that. I think sometime around the 1820s.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, if I remember correctly. New York's Central Park, on a single February day in 1862, had an estimated 12,000 skaters skating over the surface.
How could they fit?
Prospect Parkway. I'm sorry?
How did they fit?
Oh,
it's
Have you ever seen Prospect Park?
Yeah.
The lake there.
Oh, I'm not sure that I remember it.
It's huge, absolutely huge. So it doesn't surprise me any. Hmm. And, of course, because of ice skating only being a seasonal type spirit, someone had to develop roller skating.
Of course.
So a gentleman by the name of James Plimpton of Massachusetts devised a steerable roller skate in 1863. Only the most daring tried the sport. 3 years later, when he opened the first roller rink, all America strapped on wheels and a new craze was born. So in 1866, it became a popular sport throughout the United States and really around the world. And that was something that they could do year-round. They didn't just have to wait for the ponds and the rivers and things to freeze over.
Yep.
While skaters thronged to the rinks, they were warned of dire consequences in 1865 when it said that elopements, bigamous marriages, and other social transgressions were traced to the association of the innocent with the vicious on the skating floor.
Oh my goodness, who was making money off of that lie?
And it kind of reminds me of in the late 50s, going to the skating rink between Logan and Nelsonville,
uh-huh.
and you would see the what we referred to back in those days as the hoods.
The hoods.
That would show up with their rolled up
jeans
and their t-shirts with a pack of cigarettes rolled up in the air on the skating rink. So I guess those would be the vicious on the skating room floor.
You know, there's still a skating rink down there, I believe. But
is there?
I think so.
The one I recall was it was across the road from where the drive-in movie was on old Route 33. And it's set up on the hill there.
Well,
and
I
know a couple of times they had a fire there and they rebuilt it, but I have not been down that way in so many years. I don't remember whether it's even still there.
And I may be wrong. They put in a big movie thing down there on just south of Nelsonville,
mm-hmm.
and I thought they had roller skating there. But
they may have. The one I'm thinking of was between Logan and Nelsonville, which would have been north of Nelsonville.
That would have been north. Yeah.
But there was also one that was built in probably. Oh, I was still in schools, in high school, so I'm going to say maybe 1962 or 63. I think they was when the, and I can't remember their name now. I had it at the tip of my tongue. I lost it. But they built one in Logan that's when Route 33 still went through Logan,
mm-hmm.
before they had the bypass.
Mm-hmm.
But they built it near where the Burger Boy Foodorama was,
okay.
and it was a big indoor skating rink. It was built by an Italian family.
Now, we still have one here in Marion, don't we?
Right.
Up there by
Yes, it's actually behind where the Restore is.
Yeah.
Yeah, that building back there.
Yeah.
But, you know, they're beginning to be few and far between, just like a lot of things that were big fads back in the day. They just don't survive as what they used to. And another one, which isn't in my presentation today, but when you start thinking about drive-in movies, were a big fad.
Yes, they were.
You know, and having mentioned that one in Logan, that was still going. I know, clear into the 80s, they were still showing movies down there.
Yeah.
And I think, if I'm not mistaken, there's one up on Route 53 north of Tiffin that's still in operation,
huh.
between Tiffin and Fremont.
There was one down in Delaware all they did was have XXX rated.
I think that was kind of toward the end of the one in Logan and and some of these others. I think that's where they started to hang on with
trying to keep X-rated movies outside.
But extremely, very, very popular. When I was in high school, we used to see how many we could get in the trunk of
my 55 Chevy. Absolutely.
To get in for free.
I wonder if kids had ever gotten trapped in the trunks and suffocated or anything.
Well, I don't know. There was no release on the inside of the trunk
back then.
Although you could kick the back seat out.
Yeah, oh, that's right.
And go in that way. Yeah, but I think my record was 10. In the back of my 55 Chevy.
I think I only did 2.
The trunk of my 55 Chevy was huge.
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
But and then, of course, they started doing carload nights, you know, so they knew what we were doing.
Yeah, of course they did.
Yeah. So they started carload nights where you get the whole carload in for $5 or something like that.
And you know,
I could cram quite a few of my 55 Chevy in the back seat.
They didn't even make you open your trunk.
No, because they were counting
on the popcorn sales.
Exactly. The concession stand was where they were really making
their money.
They made it.
I had a great friend who owned the one in Valparaiso, Indiana, and may still be there, but he told me, he said, we made more money with kids that snuck in than when we wouldn't let them come in.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think that was true probably in a lot of these outdoor theaters.
Yeah.
They did make most of their money by the concession stand.
Right. Yeah.
And, you know, if you remember that little jingle, let's all go to the candy stand or whatever.
Yeah.
It was playing a little jingle, and the popcorn box danced around, and the Coke danced around.
And it was the same tune at every theater.
Everyone. Yeah. I think it was just one that they sent out worldwide.
Excellent.
But anyway, that was a big fad back in the day, skating. It's just not popular like it used to be. In fact, I think Marion's probably fortunate to still have an indoor skating rink.
Well, Big Bang Theory, they did a whole thing on one where the boys go out and they think they're really fancy because they got all these fancy clothes on and they know how to skate and dance while they're skating. And it kind of, the cool kids, the Penny and, I don't remember. But anyway, they kind of look askance at people that
know
how to dance.
Well, probably the closest thing now to it today would be these rollerblades.
Yeah.
The kids have.
I loved rollerblades.
And the shoes that had the skate wheels in it.
Yeah.
That were kind of a fad for a while. I don't think you see too much of those anymore. But you go out and try to buy a pair of ice skates today, and I bet you'll have a hard time finding them.
Well, when I owned my Planet Again sports store, we sold a lot of ice skates.
Did you?
Yeah.
I still
used.
See them, of course, in antique malls periodically. But I don't know whether places like Dick's or those big sports places have them.
I think you can still buy them, but they're scarce.
Well, next thing I wanted to talk about was, and we'll call it Small Green Big Hit.
Okay.
Think about what I'm going to talk about.
Small Green Big Hit. The only thing I'm thinking of is golf, but
perhaps you're on the right trail.
Okay.
Perhaps it was just another example of America's unquenchable appetite for novelty, but when the public first got a taste of miniature golf in the 1920s, they greeted it with gusto.
Really?
Although many golf courses, not M-A-N-Y, but M-I-N-I, golf courses had been built as early as 1916, it wasn't until 1927 that the relatively unknown pastime exploded into a national passion. And I didn't realize that it started that soon. I thought it came into being somewhere in the 40s.
Yeah.
But apparently the first courses were built in 1916.
Huh.
The epicenter for the action was Garnet and Frieda Carter's Mountaintop Fairyland Inn near Chattanooga, Tennessee. So it got its birth basically in Tennessee. Fairyland was already a duffer's paradise with its own professional golf course, when to keep golfers' widows amused, Mrs. Carter designed an 18-hole mini links for the inn's front lawn.
Oh, that sounds like fun, yeah.
Yeah. If artistically tamed by today's standards, her Tom Thumb course was challenging with ramps, bridges, and other traps that you had to finesse around. In no time at all, it was the hotel's chief drawing card. So people quit going to the golf course and started playing mini golf.
Yeah, it's probably cheaper.
Well, I'm sure it probably was, and a lot easier to maintain.
Yeah.
Mr. Carter, who knew a good thing when he saw it, patented his wife's design.
Huh.
The only problem to be solved before the couple could sell their new game was the playing surface. Of course, it quickly became apparent that ordinary grass wouldn't stand up to constant foot traffic, and you'd have to continually be re-sodding. When they discovered a fellow who had already devised an artificial turf made of crushed and dyed cottonseed for his backyard putting green, the Carters bought rights to the material and sold some 3,000 Tom Thumb golf courses around the United States for $4,500 each.
They got rich.
Think how much money that would translate back to now if you were talking 1920s money. Meanwhile, hundreds of imitators had gotten into the act, and by 1930, an estimated 40,000 mini golf greens had sprung up on vacant lots, motel grounds, and apartment house rooftops, and in department store salons all across the country. As the novelty of the original designs wore thin, courses were built around such themes as the Wild West, Japanese gardens, Spanish missions, and even Eskimo villages, featuring blue turf, ice floes, and snowbanks. I've never seen one of those, but I've seen some pretty unusual miniature golf courses before.
Well, we have a lovely one here in Marion.
We do.
Paradise Park is a very nice miniature golf course.
Right, been in business for quite some time.
Yeah, I actually won the, along with Drew, Drew's last name. Anyway, we won the city championship.
Really, they had a city championship.
Well, it was very, very meager.
Oh, okay. Well, during the same time, players could also subscribe to a fan magazine, and they could buy special miniature golf clothing.
Really?
Imagine this. You could buy how-to books and sheet music for a new song called "I've Gone Goofy Over Miniature Golf." Now, I've never heard the song or I've never seen the sheet music, but supposedly it does exist.
I'll be there. Now, I bet that most of the miniature golf courses had the windmill. Wouldn't
probably,
you think?
Probably, yeah. It didn't say so in the article, but I'm looking at a photograph of one of these very early ones, and there is a windmill in this photograph. And usually that windmill was the last one on the course.
Yeah, and it was a natural,
I'm sorry?
It was a natural.
And it was, it really was.
If you made it through there, you sometimes got a free game.
You got a prize or an extra game or something, right. The one that comes to mind to me that was a lot of fun, have you ever been down to Young's Dairy?
No, I haven't.
You ever heard of Young's Dairy?
No, I haven't.
It's just outside of Yellow Springs. You know where Yellow Springs is?
Vaguely, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yellow Springs, home of Antioch College.
Yep.
A town stuck in the 60s.
Yeah.
Which, believe me, it still is stuck in the 60s. We were down there a couple of years ago.
Have they opened it back? I mean, have they opened Antioch back again?
Oh, yes. It's operating again, right.
That's what I thought.
I think right now it's got an enrollment of somewhere around 500.
Okay.
It's actually owned, it was owned by the city.
Oh, really?
For a while.
It was one of those hippie reservations.
Well,
areas.
It was a pass or fail college.
Yeah.
You didn't get grades. You either passed the course or you flunked it.
Yeah.
But it was a hippie land, and it still is. If you make a trip down there today and walk the streets, you would think you were walking in about 1966.
Really? I'm going to head down
there. It's
that
well
way.
Worth going down and see.
I'm going to.
But at Young's Dairy, which is just outside of town a couple of miles, it was it still operates, and they milk Jersey cows, which is what I grew up with.
Mm-hmm.
And they have the best ice cream there. And they have a big restaurant with an ice cream parlor there, and they have two par three golf courses there, both 18-hole courses.
Mm-hmm.
And they are absolutely fabulous. So a few years ago, as I said, my wife and I took our friends down, and we had a match. The men against the women on the goofy golf course, and the men won naturally. You know, as far as that part's concerned.
I'm not going to
look out for all the women; they're going to hate me now. But it is a fun thing to do. And the other course that brings to mind is there's one up at what's the Methodist village up on Lake Erie?
Parkside. Lakeside
has a par three golf course, 18-hole par three golf course there too, but you know you don't see as many of them as you used to. They're very popular in places like Myrtle Beach and
tourists sites.
Big tourist attractions where families go.
If they sell fudge, they probably have a miniature golf course.
Right, exactly. But I did not realize until I started doing this research that the first one was built in 1916.
That is amazing.
And of course, it didn't make any difference whether you could play golf or not.
No.
Anybody could pick up a putter and play it. But on an average balmy evening in 1930, some 4 million Americans putted balls through little windmills and pagodas.
Oh, my goodness.
Isn't it amazing? 40 million in 1930.
And the country probably only had 120 million.
Most likely, yeah. Most likely, yeah. Unfortunately, of course, today they're getting harder and harder to find all the time. And we're lucky to have one here. And I know traveling to Malabar all the time and going through Lexington, there's a big one over there, too.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of a popular area because of Mohican Park, and a lot of people camp over in that area. So Lexington has a miniature golf. They also have one of those go-kart race tracks.
Oh, I used to love those. But,
and a batting cage and some other things like that.
But, my wife wouldn't let me do that because I kept trying to run my kids off the road.
You're one of those nasty drivers.
I was a bad, bad dad.
Well, that's miniature golf, which was very much of a fad in those days. And keeping along the same spirit of exercise, and I guess you could consider that a little bit of an exercise.
Sure, you got to walk around it.
Yeah. One of the very, very popular fads that was starting to emerge in the late 1800s and the early 1900s, especially in the 20s, were dances.
Dances,
especially dance marathons.
Oh yeah,
remember when they used to have dance marathons, and you would sign up for a dance marathon?
What years are you talking?
Early 20s.
Early 20s. Huh.
And it was kind of a fad that came out of the Roaring 20s.
Uh-huh.
You know, with the flapper girls and the bathtub gin and all.
One
that
of the most famous one has to be "It's a Wonderful Life."
Yeah, right. That's right.
They have a dance-a-thon.
That's
or
right.
Something.
And actually, a few years ago, when the Golden Girls was still on, I remember one of their episodes was they had a dance contest at one of their senior gatherings.
Oh.
And all the girls, you know, had partners, and they were going to see who could outlast one another. And I don't remember who won it now, but it kind of brought back the memories of the dance contest.
Yeah.
But in the 20s, especially, they would have hundreds of couples. And these would take places in places like, big ballrooms.
Didn't they make a lot of money doing it?
I don't know. There was an entrance fee, obviously, for the couples to get in the dance. But what jumps out in my mind is Meadowbrook Park up between Fostoria and Tiffin, which still exists today, had a big ballroom up there. And they used to have a lot of big bands that would come in and play. Glenn Miller played there. Harry James played there. A lot of those name bands of the day, and that was dancing, of course, but that was in the 40s. But prior to that, in the 20s, they would hold these big dance contests there, and they'd have hundreds of couples that would start out, and these things would run sometimes 24, 36, 48 hours, and the idea was to be the last couple standing, and if you were the last couple that was on the floor, when everybody else had either passed out or fallen down or whatever, then you won the prize, which is usually a loving cup and some money.
Mm-hmm.
So it was extremely popular, and they were doing dances like the Charleston and the Lindy Hop and things like that, of course, in the 20s, some of those early, really early dances.
The flappers.
Exactly. Guy by the name of, what was his name? Benjamin Lovett. He was a dancing master back in the 20s. He was known for his devotion to square dancing, which was also very, very popular in the time. But in 1924, he began teaching dancing at Greenfield Village. And that's, of course, up where Ford's Dearborn, Michigan, Ford's hometown, where he developed that Greenfield Village up there.
Right.
2 years after that, Ford and his wife published an instruction book with dance steps laid out by Lovett called Good Morning. And this was a title explained by the subtitle, after a sleep of 25 years, old-fashioned dancing is being revived by Mr. and Mrs. Henry Ford. The campaign to reawaken interest in square dancing and similar forms had mixed results at best, but that didn't stop Ford from erecting a state-of-the-art dance hall at Greenfield Village, and I think that is still there.
Is that right?
I think so, because we were up there a couple of years ago, and I do remember seeing that hall. I don't think it's a dance hall now, but the building itself is still there. And a lot of these dance contests, these marathon dance contests, were also held in facilities like that. And a lot of these places were built, they were called dancing castles. They were very elegant buildings. And most of this was occurring during what we refer to as the Jazz Age, which came about at the same time in the 1920s. People like Louis Armstrong and guys like that were in their 20s and the early age were getting started playing, and they played in a lot of these places that were called castles. For a few short years before World War I, there were a couple, I can't remember their name right now, but they were kind of like American royalty when it came to dancing.
Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers.
They would go around and help people get started with these dancing crazes. Irene wore her hair bobbed, which was very popular in the 20s. She had wrapped a band of seed pearls around the bob. If you've ever seen flappers and what flappers look like, pearls were very popular. Of course, the dresses were short, usually had fringe around the bottom, or they were decorated with pearls and baubles and things like that. But they would go around and help getting these places started by training people and teaching them how to do some of these dances. And then eventually they would help to create these large buildings. They would help raise the money to build these buildings, which they called dancing castles.
That's interesting.
So that was extremely popular, a big fad through the 20s and 30s. And, of course, it evolved because into the 1940s, when the swing bands started to make their appearance during World War II, as we mentioned, you know, earlier, people like Harry James and Glenn Miller and all those, the Dorseys and those people started traveling around the country playing music in these big dancing, what used to be dancing halls, where they could still dance. And by then it had changed to swing music, and you know, they weren't doing the Charleston and the Lucky Lindy anymore.
Right.
They were doing dances that were popular at the time. But a very, very popular thing and a very big fad in the 20s and into the 30s.
Well, I'm afraid we're not going to be able to get to your next fad because we're down to about a minute and a half.
And there's still a bunch of other fads that I wanted to talk about.
We'll do it next time.
We'll kind of talk about some of those the next time. When did ladies start wearing trousers? That became a fad.
Oh, yeah.
Corsets and crinolines, that was a fad. Games like Mahjong and Bingo and ping pong.
I remember the Mahjong.
A lot of stuff still to talk about. So maybe we'll finish up with fads the next time, and then the following month we'll talk about fashion.
Okay. Now, my wife tells me that I should have gone into fashion because every time I see people on TV, I say, now, that scarf doesn't look nice.
And so you missed your calling.
Yeah, I missed my calling. Yeah, but I'm kind of glad I didn't go into that.
Yeah, well, you could have been the next Halston or Louis Vuitton or one of those people.
I hope I wouldn't be like Halston. But I'm going to see his movie, though.
Hey, yeah, me too.
Yeah.
I'll do that.
All right, well, Fred, I'm thinking Fred Astaire here.
Yeah, that's all right. I've been called that before, too.
Well, anyway, we'll be looking forward to continuing this discussion in about a month.
All right.
And hopefully people get out to the Historical Society and get in and start warming up the seats in
right
there for you.
Wednesday through Sunday, 1 to 4.
Excellent. Well, thanks a lot.
Have a great one.
Been a great day. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right. Very good. That was, we will get back to having him back next month, and we will talk more about that. It sounds like a lot of interesting things we're going to talk about. Have a great day, everybody.
You're listening to WWGH Radio 107.1 FM LP Marion, Ohio, The Talking Place.